Men Achieving in Healthcare panel. Happy to have you all. Hope you enjoyed your lunch and learns. I am Crystal, Head of Community for Black Health Connect, and I'm going to be introducing our lovely moderator, Dr. Brandon Frame. So Dr. Brandon Frame stands as a visionary leader, serving as the founder and chief visionary officer of the Black Man Can, Inc. This nonprofit organization is dedicated to creating and amplifying the remarkable stories of what Black men and boys are capable of achieving. He's a graduate from Morehouse and received his doctorate from Boston University. His impactful work has garnered attention from esteemed publications such as Black Enterprise, Boston Globe, and Essence, and he has been featured on prominent television networks including CBS, NBC, ABC, BT, HLN, and New York One, where he was celebrated as New Yorker of the Week. So let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Brandon Frame.
Greetings, everyone. I'm beyond excited to be here for the second time, which means that I did a good job last year, so they invited me back. So I'm happy to be here. Before I bring up the panelists, I want to share something with you. So the Black Man Can has lots of programs. We operate summer programs all throughout the country. And one of our programs, I flew in on a red eye this morning from LA. One of our programs is out in LA. It's at a juvenile facility. So I was talking to the boys about we're doing all this work, and then I'm like, yeah, I have to go fly to DC. I'll be back on Monday. And they were like, how do you do that, right? And just with and everything. But I was showing them like the website Black Health Connect. And so when I came in on Friday, one of the boys, he wrote a letter because I was just telling them what I was doing, and it was for all of you. So I just want to share that with you before I bring up everyone. And so I can't say his name because he's a youth, but he said, dear healthcare professionals, I'm writing to you from within the confines of incarceration. Despite my current circumstances, I'm inspired and filled with hope seeing all the photos on that Black Health Connect website. Your accomplishments remind me that greatness knows no bounds and that we too can rise above our circumstances to make a meaningful impact. So I just wanted to share that with you because that's words from a young man in LA. And that's why we're here, and thinking about the work that we do, that's why we do the work. There's people here that probably work with that population as well in the work that you do, and so we're all an inspiration to so many, right? So we bring up the panel. So first, joining us is Dr. Tony Coleman. Next, joining us here is Dr. Jeff Rocker. And coming to the stage is Joelle Burvell. So this is our panel for Black men leading and achieving in healthcare, and we're about to get into a really dynamic conversation. All right, gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you all here. And so we're actually filming an episode of our podcast at the Black Man Can called The Men's Den. And how we like to start The Men's Den is actually allowing you to introduce yourself. But introducing yourself, answering this one question, and Joelle, we're going to start with you. Tell us why you him. Why were you selected to be on the panel? Tell us about who you are and what makes you special.
Sure, I'll try my best. Hey everyone, my name is Joelle Burvell. I'm a fourth year medical student, but online I'm better known as the medical mythbuster to over a million followers for talking about healthcare equity and healthcare disparities that exist in the field of medicine. I think oftentimes when I'm speaking on stage, it's to people that don't often get the problem. I think here we all know what the problems are. My goal on social media is really to share content that people may never have heard about that impacts communities that look like ours. Why is it that equations exist that treat Black and brown bodies differently than all other races when it comes to kidneys, when it comes to heart health, when it comes to first-line treatments for hypertension. And as a medical student, I was really just going through medical school questioning a lot of the things we were learning when it came to race. So I think the reason why I'm here today is because I feel like I found an innovative way of reaching new audiences for problems that have existed for a long time and trying to reframe how we can think about systemic racism in healthcare and really break down how we can solve it by understanding the problems first.
Mythbusters. I love it. Yes. Let's give them a round of applause. Dr. Jeff Rocker, tell us why you him. Why you here? Why you special? Why you one of them ones?
I've been here for a while now, but it's so, but my, like I said, my name is Dr. Jeff Rocker, also known as a celebrity therapist, mainly for the work that I do across the country, work, of course, working with celebrities, professionals, and people within the entertainment industry. And I'm also a licensed in 25 states, so that definitely is a eye catcher when I hear the 25 states, because for those of you know who to get licensed in one state, it's a hassle, but to be licensed in 25, those state users are killing me right now, so. But you gotta do what you gotta do. But so I also have a company called Rocker Health where I provide luxury and quality services to, of course, professionals and people within the community. And I also have another company called Rocker Community Health where I do different services like hip hop therapy where I teach kids and the youth and, of course, young adults about mental health through use of hip hop. So I do a little bit of everything. I'm all about, you know, keeping it real and just teaching and paving the way for other people coming behind me because I'm in the field of mental health. And I know I've been taught a long time ago that we don't make no money. And I'm here to dispel that myth because I make good money. And I want to make sure that everybody knows that you can make money in this field of mental health. So that's why I'm here today.
All right. I love that. Dispelling all the myths in all the areas. I appreciate you. Let's give him a round of applause. And Dr. Tony Coleman, tell us why you him, why you special, what makes you do the things you do.
Right. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Dr. Tony Coleman, the CEO of Cedar Hill Regional Medical Center. It's the first new hospital in D.C. in 20 years. We're building it as I speak in Southeast D.C. And I'm here because I'll give you a little bit of geography about the healthcare landscape in Washington, D.C., because it's a microcosm of the country and really the world. So in Washington, D.C., you have eight wards. It's segregated into eight wards. And wards 7 and 8 are in Southeast D.C. They're east of the Anacostia River. Southeast D.C. is where we live, where all the black folks live. And the life expectancy in Southeast D.C. is 15 years less than it is in the other parts of D.C., right, in the nation's capital in 2024. So talk about being forgot about. Talk about systemic racism, as he mentioned, or lack of cultural competency. So I'm here to build a hospital and serve our people and make sure that black folks in D.C. understand that they deserve the same type of health care that everyone else gets. And I'm here to keep an eye on the life expectancy and the health status of our people and make sure that we collectively elevate it. My passion is eliminating health disparities, pursuing health equity, and achieving health justice. And while I may not achieve that in my lifetime, I'm quite comfortable making that my life's work. That's why I'm here.
Powerful. So as I think about this and listening to the amazing accomplishments as we talk about leading and achieving, I think we just have to start with that moment, that catalyst moment where you're like, oh, I want to be in healthcare. Who were you? Tell us a little about who you were, that middle school, high school, college individual to where you are now. And like, when was that catalyst? What was that light bulb moment? And Dr. Rocker, you can start and tell us, what was the light bulb moment? You're like, this is what I want to do. This is the field I want to be in.
Well, let me just say, I never thought a day in my life I'd be in this field. Because, you know, I'm a kid from Miami. For those of you know, for inner city black kid, all the way out of the hood is sports. So for me, basketball, I thought I was going to be a rapper. I went through that stage, right? So, but once I realized I was not going to be, I wasn't going to the NBA, which is, it broke my heart, I had to pivot. But then I told myself, what can I pivot to? And for me, I'm looking around the surface and the environment. I'm like, damn, what's something that can make me money, but also is it could be fun? And I was like, being a therapist? Hell no, that's not it. But someone talked to me, said, you know what, you should be, because in the field of mental health, they need more black men. Because this is a field that's dominated by women and also by other cultures. But black men, as you can see in front of us, you don't see this many black men in the field of mental health. So I said, you know what, let me go try it out. But when I got involved with it, I realized, damn, there is no money in this. And that broke my heart because I think for most of you guys who've been in this predicament, you thought about probably changing careers. And I've been through that stage as well. So that's what made me switch to between being a traditional therapist to now specifying a certain population. But those who don't know that I used to act back in the day, model, musician, and I'm an athlete too. So I decided, how can I incorporate all those four aspects of my personal interest into the people I work with? And that's what guided me to be a celebrity therapist that you see in front of you today. But I realized for me, it's not just about me doing this, it's about me paving the way and showing people that being creative, being different, being special is the best way to, of course, take care of yourself, but also make a difference within this community. Because if you can't be personable, if you can't be yourself, if you can't let your hair down or be, you know, just have fun, showing that the community that you can be cool, you can be, you know, chill. I would say, as doctors, you could pop bottles in the club one day and have a lab coat another day. They got to be able to see that. I know you're laughing, but it's true, though, because one thing about my field is that 50% of the battle is about building relationships. and being personable. So if you can't be personable to your community, then you already lost them. So for me, I always want to show practitioners, professionals, that I want you to learn how to be both. Be the professional that you know you are, and also be yourself too, because that's how you connect with the community. So thank you.
I love that. Be a professional yourself, and you can be in your community, and you can pop bottles. You can do it all. I love that.
Yeah, you be all around.
Joel, tell us a little about your story.
So my parents are Ghanaian immigrants, and I think a lot of people resonate with this, but they told me I could be one of three things, either a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. Yep. And really that's because that's all they knew when they came to the United States, that they wanted us to do better than they had opportunities for when they were growing up. And so for me, I always had it in my head that I wanted to not be a lawyer. Although I did love to argue, I didn't want to be an engineer because my dad was an engineer. So doctor was kind of, this sounds weird, but a fallback for me in terms of like thinking, oh, this is something that I could possibly do. But I think what kept me driven towards it, because there were so many moments where I was like, I don't know if I want to do medicine anymore, was wanting to prove other people wrong. So I grew up in Seattle, Washington. If you know anything about Seattle, less than 2% of the entire population there is black. And so I was often, almost always, the only one in my class that was a black person. And oftentimes, students would be saying things like, oh, Joel, you're black. Why are you in AP English? Oh, Joel, you're black. Why are you doing this? Making these assumptions about me. Or I remember, and I'm curious actually if other people have been called this, but people would call me an Oreo. Has anyone else been called that? Okay, yeah, so if you don't know what that means, it's like you're black on the outside, white on the inside. And I learned really early on to challenge what people thought about blackness. When someone would call me an Oreo, I'd literally turn to them and say, what does that mean? And they'd say, oh, well, you're student body president. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? Oh, well, you're really working hard. Okay, what does that mean? I can't do that if I'm white. If I'm black, I have to be white. They're like, oh, that's not what I meant, you know. And so I learned to ask the five whys really early on, and I think that's what got me interested in healthcare, was I was always asking and pushing myself to get into a field that I didn't see people that often looked like me. I think it was in my junior year of college, though, that really like solidified, even though I was in pre-med, doing all the classes already, I had an internship actually here in Washington, D.C., at Howard University Hospital in their orthopedic surgery department with Dr. Terry Thompson. And it was my first time ever getting to work with a black doctor. And I remember just like looking at the patient population, watching how Dr. Terry Thompson was just taking care of his patients, and being so incredibly inspired and knowing that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And so for me, when I look at the whole trajectory of everything I do, I think it stems from one, proving people wrong, reframing narratives, and then questioning why our systems the way they are. And I think that's really what's pushed me into medicine.
Powerful story, and it's so interesting when you ask everybody about the Oreo, because I experienced that too. So many hands went up, right? It just says so much around what we have to do more around blackness and how we define it. Dr. Coleman, tell us about a little bit about your story.
My story is a story of crossroads. I'm the youngest of three, dirty-faced kid from the ghetto, born and raised in Los Angeles. And when I got ready to go to college, or when I graduated high school, actually, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I firmly believe that our parents can only give us what they have to give, and what they don't have, they can't give us. So my mother had not gone to college. She actually became pregnant with my oldest sister when she was 15. And so my mother's advice to us was, or her directive or whatever you want to call it, was graduate high school and don't have any babies, because that's what she did. So that was what she had to give us. So when it came time for me to graduate high school, I knew that I wasn't ready for college. I could have gone and wasted time and money, but I watched my mother take care of my older brother and sister when they went to college and take care of me. And she was within 2 years of retiring when I graduated, and I knew that if I went to college, she wouldn't retire. She would keep working to take care of me like she did my older brother and sister. So I decided to join the Navy. And my plan was to enlist for 4 years and get what was called the GI Bill to pay for college. While I was in the Navy, I ended up getting married and having a daughter, getting divorced all in 4 years. And I found myself as a single parent to a little girl. And I knew that I couldn't continue my military career and raise my daughter. So when I went to shore duty, I rotated off of the ship and I went to shore duty for 3 years. And my plan was to get an education, become a teacher. So I went to school, and long story short, I ended up meeting a Navy officer that ran hospitals, military hospitals. And at that time, I was fascinated because the only Navy officers that I knew were war fighters and ship drivers, because that was where I came from. So she talked to me about a program. I ended up applying to become a Navy healthcare administrator, and I got accepted. The Navy sent me to grad school. While I was in grad school, between my first and second year, I went to the Medical University of South Carolina, and that summer between year one and year two, I did a rural internship in Union County, South Carolina. Union County is about an hour away from the capital of South Carolina. And when you make that drive from the capital of South Carolina to Union County, it's almost like going back in time 50 years. And I went to this hospital, Wallace Thompson Hospital, and I did about 10 rotations. My favorite rotation was in the kitchen. And I worked with this woman named Pee-wee, who was the kitchen supervisor. Pee-wee was a black woman. She was in her mid-40s. Pee-wee and I connected with Pee-wee because she reminded me of my mother and my mother's family. My mother was from Alabama. And so I would stand with Pee-wee in the kitchen and watch her fill trays for patients. And each tray that would come had a ticket based on the patient's dietary restriction. And so ever so often, Pee-wee would put, she would draw a happy face on a ticket. And I thought, well, what's that about? And so I just kind of paid attention. And I learned a couple of other things about Pee-wee. I learned that Pee-wee, when she left the hospital, she went to go work at Hardee's fast food because she had two jobs to make ends meet. So I learned that your hospital food workers and your hospital sanitation workers are the lowest paid in the hospital. But raise your hand if you would go to a hospital that didn't have housekeepers. Right? I wouldn't do it. So those are the people that you need. So Pee-wee was filling these trays, she would draw a happy face ever so often. And one day I went with Pee-wee up to the patient rooms to deliver the meals. And she took a tray that had the ticket with a happy face. And she walked over to a patient in the bed and she leaned over ever so gently. And she said, "When I came yesterday, I noticed that you didn't have a smile. So I thought I would give you one of mine." And I thought, wow, what a way to facilitate the healing environment. Here's a woman who, according to our standards, isn't educated. She's not a doctor, she's not a nurse, she doesn't even have a high school diploma, but she's using the love in her heart to heal people. And so that further endeared me to Pee-wee. Long story short, went back to school, graduated, kept up with Pee-wee and a couple other black folks in Union. And I found out about 4 years later that Pee-wee died from a stroke. Pee-wee was, I don't think she was even 50 years old. So that hurt me. It's almost like, you know how we get when like a singer died, like when Luther Vandross died, we felt like, you know, we hurt, like we knew Luther. That's how we do. That's how I felt when Pee-wee died. And so I started to look at why black people die of certain diseases at a higher rate than others. And that's when I realized it was my mission to eliminate health disparity. It was my calling to take the knowledge and the experience that I had been given and use it to help people who either could not or did not know how to help themselves. And so I had to go back to the Navy and pay back time for the education they gave me, but I knew at that moment that as soon as I got out of the Navy, I was gonna help black people and other people. My mission has expanded. It started with us, but it has expanded, but help people and help eliminate health disparities. So retired from the military, and I started selecting jobs that were aligned with my social mission from that point on. And that's what brought me to this point.
Wow, that was moving. I felt it. I'm looking at everybody's faces. That was a really powerful testimony. And thank you for sharing that and sharing your story. I want to start right with this next question, come over to Dr. Rocker, and thinking about as black men and leading and achieving, we still face our unique challenges. And there's unique challenges that we just face as black men in healthcare, just in the world alone. Could you share some of any unique challenges that you faced as a black man in healthcare and how you have overcome them?
That's quite a few challenges as a black man, but I think one of the things I've seen that's very common is a lack of support from your own community. And you think, why? Why is that? Why, as a successful black man in front of you, why do other black men don't support you? Because we're always competing amongst each other. We are willing to tear each other down rather than support our brothers and sisters. And that's something that I think as a community, as a culture, we must stop doing that. If you see your sister doing big things, compliment her. If you see your brother doing big things, let them know how good they're doing. But one thing you cannot do is tear them down. In addition to that, I think representation matters so much in the field of healthcare because we don't see a lot of black people in this field. And because we don't see a lot of them, a lot of people don't trust healthcare professionals. And if you don't trust healthcare professionals, now you don't get the help that you need within this field. And that's where the diseases start coming about. You know, mental health issues come about, and then ultimately you find yourself going through a gradually slow death. And as a culture, we do not need, we've been through enough. We've been through slavery, been through, discrimination. And we're still going to discrimination in some parts, but one thing we cannot do is that we cannot be the reason that we tear each other down. The world's hard enough as it is, but as a culture, we must stand with one another. And that's why I'm so happy to see so many people of color in this room, because it shows me that we're heading the right direction. I mean, the job is not done as of yet, but we still have a long way to go. But this is where it starts, having this conversation, being open, being honest, teaching others, paving the way for others, because we owe it to ourselves and the people coming after us to make this world a better place. Thank you.
Big facts. It costs us nothing to shout each other out, to give each other flowers, and we have to stand on business and make sure that we do that as much as possible. Dr. Coleman, same for you, right? Being a CEO, tell us about some unique challenges that you faced in your career and how you've overcome them when it comes to being a Black man in healthcare.
Yeah, no, I think I'll echo everything you said, but an additional challenge is something that I learned. I think people fear what they don't understand. And so even when I was a naval officer, I was one of the only Blacks, wherever I went, and even now in healthcare administration. One thing that I learned is you have to, and this goes for Black men as well as Black women, just Black people, you have to learn to disarm the room as soon as you walk in, before you even open your mouth. Because people are gonna have their sacred cows, their strongly held beliefs, they're gonna have their preconceived notions of who you are based on what they saw on TV. Whether it was the news that morning or whether it was the shy that they were or whatever. And so you have to disarm people with your smile. You have to be willing to engage in conversation. And the challenge to that is, you have to be able to do that without losing who you are, without being fake or phony or what have you. But you definitely have to disarm people, because if people fear you and they don't understand you, then they're gonna be less likely to give you opportunities. Sometimes it's about racism, but more often than not, it's about familiarity. People naturally want to promote people that look like them, right? Like in this crowd, I feel more comfortable here than when I'm speaking at ACHE or wherever else, because I'm with my people. It's about familiarity. And so when you're in those spaces where we don't have a lot of us, you have to use whatever it is in you to make them feel familiar. And also to your point, we also got to know when to sit down and when to pass the torch, right? We cannot die holding the crown. We got to know when to step aside and when to promote, right? My COO here, my chief operating officer is here, Vaughn Williams, young brother. And so one of the things that I learned in the Navy is you train your relief, train the person coming behind you, because I could walk out of here and get hit by a bus and that's that. Then Vaughn's got it. But have I trained Vaughn? Have I given Vaughn everything he needs to run the hospital and continue the mission after I'm gone? So I think train your relief. Vaughn is a witness to that. Young brother, he's single, by the way, ladies. And so that's what I would say, train your relief. And shameless plug for my boy, Vaughn.
You want to stand up, brother? Raise your hand up. There you go. Yeah, just so everybody knows who we're talking about. There he is.
Check him out, ladies. Check him out.
I think he's on good Tinder, brother. Too. I think he's on Tinder as well.
Good brother.
I think that resonates. I think what you just said, there was a lot of people just shaking their head, right? And there's a lot of honesty and relatability to that. Joelle, can you just share a little bit for yourself as well, just unique challenges and how you've overcome them?
Yeah, I think I have to second everything that was said and add on to it. I think for me, it's the idea of being one of the only, right? When you get to these spaces, when you're in a professional space where less than 6% of all doctors are Black, you don't see people that look like you often. I think for me, one of the biggest burdens, especially at my medical school, I always preface it by saying this, but Washington State University, relatively new school, it's been around for 6 years now, but myself and one other student were the first two Black students at my medical school. And so I came in kind of knowing that, but also feeling this responsibility to make sure that I wasn't just gonna be the first and the last, but I could open the doors for people that came afterwards. I think all of us can feel that when we're thinking about like relief and how do we actually build the next generation, but it's also how do you open the doors that so that people can actually get there in the first place. I think for me, some of the biggest challenges have really been, how do I sit in a space, but also make sure at the same time, while like succeeding and excelling in that space, that I'm also opening the door afterwards, mentoring, letting people know about how I got to this space, all those kind of things. So at my medical school, one of the things I really made sure to focus on was legacy. And so that was building things like putting a Student National Medical Association at my school, being student body president so I could work with administration and create pathway programs for students that often don't get MCAT training or don't get interview prep, making sure that I started a mentorship program so that we could actually be going out into the communities to low-income schools and making sure that we are inspiring students from a young age. But I think a lot of it is difficult when you're the only one having to prove yourself and explain to people why it matters. And so for me, it's been figuring out, how do you identify the right stakeholders? How do you get those stakeholders to understand what's at stake and why it matters, not just for our community, but to other people as well? And making a value proposition so you can bring other people that don't look like us, but maybe have more power in spaces to come along with us. And then once you get to those positions, making sure you bring other people along, teach them the same thing, and figure out how you can get there. And so I look at myself now and the fact that I sit on councils with the White House and work with the Surgeon General's office and all these types of things. But right now what I'm thinking is, how do I get more people to be doing similar things to myself, like whether that's using social media to amplify different causes, whether it's actually getting involved in these federal agencies, making sure that people understand how government works, and thinking beyond just kind of the individual amount of racism that we often think about, thinking bigger to actually change systems. I think that's one thing that we haven't done enough of, is figuring out, and the other side, unfortunately, does very well, is thinking about, how does policy drive change? And when we put policy out there to drive change, it actually creates systems-level changes that exist for years to come, as opposed to just 5-10 years down the line. It can actually help generations. So that was a long answer, but all to say that I think when you're the only one, remembering that you have to be opening the entire system for people that come after, and it's not just about bringing people in, but teaching them to help those that come after, and then changing the entire system, bring other people that don't look like you along with you.
I love it. I love it. And so coming to some individual questions, I want to start with Tony and thinking about the work that you're doing. Talk to us a little bit about developing and implementing a strategic vision that meets the bottom line, but also really make sure you take care of patients and the community.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I appreciate you asking me that. So I'm not a religious person, but I'm going to use a scripture from the Bible, and I'll paraphrase it. It says that wherever a man's heart is, so you will also find his treasure. And so when we talk about our social mission being aligned with what we do, when we sit down to the table and we develop our strategic plan, it's good to talk about money. We must talk about quality. We must talk about safety. We also must include community, right? You have to have the stakeholders. When you're talking about elevating the health status of a community, the first step is sitting with the people closest to the pain and the problems. And I just got to DC 6 months ago. I would not presume to know how to solve the problem of healthcare in Southeast DC without the people that have lived with that problem for years. So you have to sit with those folks, invite them to the table, ask them what the problems are, and then also you put some money behind it, right? You have to put your treasure behind it. It can't just be all talk. So that's kind of the biggest thing. Anytime I look at companies, if I'm interviewing for a company or if I'm thinking about making a transition, I look at their strategic plan and I see where their community, how robust is their community benefit program? How robust is it in theory, and how robust is it in actual dollars? What kind of dollars? What kind of staff? Is your community development department an army of one? Or is it rolled up under HR and it's just half a person? Is it an afterthought? Or is it a strategic priority that sits at the table with the CEO? At my last hospital where I was CEO, we started a DEI program, and I had my DEI officer reporting directly to me and sitting at all my executive leadership team meetings, because we cannot lose sight of the goal, right? We can't. And you have to have a strong conviction that is connected to your passion, strong enough to be able to walk away from opportunities that don't push you where you want to go or don't point you in the direction that you want to go. You got to be able to say, you know, this is no longer aligned with my social mission. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to, you know, find something else to do. You got to have that kind of conviction. And if you do that, the money will come, the happiness will come, all that stuff will come, right? If you dedicate, you devote your life to helping people who either cannot or do not know how to help themselves, everything else will be taken care of. I guarantee it.
That's good. Can you share the paraphrase of the scripture again?
Oh, it says, wherever a man's heart is, you will always find his treasure.
That's it right there.
You got any preacher's kids in the room? Y'all know? Y'all look it up for me. Tell me what scripture it is.
Dr. Rocker, thinking about your work with high-profile clients, how has that maybe influenced your practice? And maybe what are lessons that you can share that you've learned that we can apply to general healthcare and working with high-profile individuals?
Well, one of the reasons why I started working with celebrities is because I always thought about I want to reverse engineer saving the world by saving the people that people look up to in the world. And because one thing I knew is that if I told, if I helped, I'll just give you an example. If I, we're going to work with LeBron James and help him with mental health. And LeBron just puts a social media post that, you know, said, you know what, mental health is good. You guys should go check out therapy. Guess what? A million followers that will go to good therapy. So now, although he has a bigger platform, that's why I decided to work with that population, because I know that they can make a big difference if they get the necessary help that they're looking for. Now, one of the things that they struggle with, and the people with high-profile clients, like professionals that's in the room like here, is work-life balance. Anybody struggle with that? I do from time to time as well, so trust me, you ain't the only one. And one of the things I realized, because people realize, is that in the beginning, when you're trying to build a business and you're an entrepreneur, you feel like you have to spend a lot of hours building that business, 14-hour days, 16-hour days. And mind you, there's only 24-hour days in a day, right? So the rest of the time, you're probably sleeping. That means you have no time for self, no time for family, no time for relationships. And that's not the way to live life. And I'm here to tell you that there's ways to be effective in your work, but still, you know, delegate time for yourself and other priorities in your life. But you got to be conscious about it. You have to be intentional about it. And I think as professionals, sometimes we lose sight of that. Because sometimes we're like, you know what, I don't have to eat today. I don't have to sleep today. I don't have to take care of myself. I don't have to go to the gym today. And really, if that's something that you consider as a priority in your life, that you say, I want to do this, I want to accomplish this, then you got to make a conscious effort to do so. But to do that, you got to create a routine. But people sometimes don't like making routines. That's one thing I realized, you know, a scheduled, structured routine. But in doing so, it could save a lot of problems if you were to do that. So work-life balance is one of them. And another one is being emotionally intelligent about how you feel about certain things. Now, as Black men, and trust me, I struggle with that too from time to time, the ability to identify how you feel when you feel it, so someone who's dealing with you can know how to interact with you, could change your whole situation if you learn how to be emotionally intelligent in that moment. What does that look like? I feel overwhelmed. I feel disappointed. Those terms, you know, sometimes when people ask you how you doing, what do most people say? I'm good, I'm fine, I'm straight. Very simplistic answers that does not describe not exactly how you feel. And I get tired of hearing that, because I promise you, if someone knew how you actually feel, they would approach you very differently if you take the time to share how you feel. Now, on the other hand, sometimes the reason why we don't share is because we feel like the world doesn't care how we feel. Especially, man, once I'm going back to men, because I know we struggle with this all the time. So all my men in this building, listen to me right now when I'm saying that. We struggle with this, but we need to share how we feel, because if the world doesn't know, then they can't help us. And I'm telling you right now, the women in here, they want to support us. They really do. And that's what I love my Black woman. Yes, I love my Black woman. But they cannot help us if you don't tell them how you feel. So vulnerability amongst men, just amongst every man, men and women, but especially men, could go a long way if they take more of an effort to just identify those issues.
Leading with vulnerability.
Yes.
I love that. Joelle, thinking about what the work that you're doing, tell us how you use social media to dispel some of the most pervasive myths that exist in the world around healthcare.
Absolutely. So I'll take you guys back to kind of when I got started on my social media platforms, because it wasn't what I was expecting, but it's kind of blown into this thing that I've always been passionate about and get to share those passions now. But I started medical school in 2019, and if you remember around that time, a few months later, COVID hit. And so I started medical school. I think we had 2-3 months of classes in person, and then suddenly we were all virtual, and we were online for everything. And during this time period, I had a lot of time to think to myself, and there was a lot of stuff happening, if we remember back to that. There was George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, all these stories that we were hearing in the news that were harrowing. And I was sitting at home being like, I'm one of the first 2 Black students at my medical school in a field where less than 6% of physicians are Black. Why am I not doing more to talk about things I've seen about racism in medical school? For example, whenever we were talking about COVID in medical school, we often said that the Black population was more likely to get COVID than any other race. But we never dove into the historical reasons why. We didn't talk about the social, political, or economic reasons that informed that and actually caused specific populations to be more predisposed to getting something like COVID when you aren't able to go out and actually have virtual work. You have to actually go in person, be a first-line worker. And all these types of things I kept hearing in medical school where we were pathologizing race, and it didn't make sense to me. So I did what kind of any other Gen Z / millennial, I call myself a zillennial, would do, and I jumped on TikTok to start talking about it. One of the first videos I made was about this device called a pulse oximeter. Do people know what that is? See, that's why I love talking to healthcare workers. We know what it is. So pulse oximeter, and it goes in your finger, and it measures your blood oxygen saturation level. I'd read this study when I was home, December 2020, and it was actually posted by someone on their Instagram story. And the study showed that in black patients and people with darker skin tones, pulse oximeters are three times as likely to be inaccurate and overestimated when compared to other people with lighter skin tones. And I was shocked. This is a device we use all the time in the hospital, right? We use it to triage, to understand if patients are hypoxemic. But I'd never learned about this in my pulmonology class, my cardiology class. I read about it in an Instagram story that someone had put in an article from the New England Journal of Medicine. And so made a video about it, posted it, and 24 hours later, it got over 500,000 views. And it had doctors and nurses and pharmacists saying, I use this device all the time, and I never knew this existed. And that scared me to know that doctors that are giving this and using it during the COVID pandemic to understand if they should triage patients didn't know that a disparity like this could exist. And studies later actually subsequently showed that more black patients were turned away from hospitals and not given supplemental oxygen because of the disparities with the pulse oximeter. So that was the first video I made. And I remember my sister's here today. Rachel, can you just raise your hand? Because I just love to give her so much shout outs. She's a doctor. She inspired me into medicine too. But after I posted that video the next day, I ran to her room and I said, Rachel, look at this. People didn't know about this disparity. And she goes, actually, did you know about this one? And we started making a whole list of disparities that we had seen in both in our medical school and outside of medical school about disparities that exist in healthcare. Things like the GFR equation. Have people heard about that one? Okay, so I'm so happy because I made the video about the GFR in 2020 before it had gotten any national attention, really. It was the first video on TikTok to be made about it. But for those who maybe haven't heard about it, GFR stands for glomerular filtration rate. It's a measure of how well your kidneys work, essentially. If you have a high GFR number, your kidneys work well. If you have a low GFR number, your kidneys aren't working very well. For decades, there's been a racial correction applied to the GFR equation that assumes that all black people have better kidney functioning just because of our race. And when you go back to the research why, it really related to the belief that all black people had higher muscle mass, so that we had more of this muscle breakdown protein called creatinine. That doesn't make sense, especially when we think about race as a social construct, that you can't look at someone's genes and understand what their race is. Yet this is how we, in medicine, use this equation that caused black people to be less likely to get kidney transplants, black people to be less likely to be diagnosed with higher levels of chronic kidney disease, and less likely to be referred to kidney specialists. It wasn't until 2021 that a new equation without race was implemented. It wasn't until 2023 the Organ Procurement and Transportation Network said, anyone that's had this equation used, we're going to go back and actually retrospectively look and adjust people's wait times. I had a woman reach out to me. Her name's Anise, in my Instagram DMs. And she said she'd been following as I talked about the kidney equation kind of all over these years. And her sister had chronic kidney disease, and she'd been sending her sister these videos. When she found out about the potential that her sister could be changed on the kidney transplant list, she sent her the video. Her sister took it to her doctor. Her doctor said, let me look into this. And they were able to move her up 5 years on the kidney transplant list. So when I think about using social media, that's the impact I'm trying to have. Giving information when it comes to racism in medicine about how we can take into our own hands and actually make a change. And actually, 3 months ago now in March, I actually had a chance to be on the Kelly Clarkson show, and they surprised me and brought Anise out. Her sister, unfortunately, couldn't be there because literally the day before, her sister had just gotten her kidney transplant. And so it was like really a full circle moment for me. And Anise wrote this incredible letter for me that I now literally have framed on my wall. But it was the first time where I was like, okay, this is real life. I started making these videos during the COVID pandemic when literally no one was around me. I'm home with just my friends. Was just posting because I thought it was interesting. And now the real world impact is actually coming back.
Black men leading and achieving in healthcare. This is powerful. So we want to turn it over to questions from everyone here in attendance. So I see the hands going up. I'm not sure if I'm the one that's going to go around or there's a microphone. Oh, yep, in the crowd. And I think right there. Yes.
Hi, I'm Sakai. Thank you guys for doing the panel. We're all very glad that you're here. Initially, you guys said something about this kind of like disarming. And I wanted to know, being in the healthcare field where you are surrounded by people who you know, don't look like you. How do you draw the line between disarming as far as like trying to get, you know, further ahead or trying to help people like understand you, and then on the flip side of it, feeling like you are kind of like responsible for changing somebody's perspective and they're not doing the necessary work on their end to strengthen or change their perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mentioned disarming, so if you don't mind, I'll take that. I think, you know, what I do is you try to find a common ground. Before that, I always say a smile goes a long way. And my mother would always say, it's nice to be nice. When you're nice, when you have a nice spirit, people pick up on that before you say anything. A smile goes a long way. It invites conversation. And then you find a common ground. I'll go back to my COO, Vaughn. He'll tell you, if you meet him 2 seconds later, he'll tell you he's from Brooklyn, New York. He's very proud of it, right? So Vaughn finds that, he finds that common ground, right? He went to Michigan. He finds, you know, he loves sports. Find that common ground. First, you be nice. You have a nice spirit, rather. It's nice to be nice. You disarm them with a smile, and you find that common ground. You can do all three of those things, and also drop the feeling of responsibility for changing anybody, right? We're not here to change anybody. Can't change anybody. You can't change the person that you are married to, right? Let alone a person that you just met. So I would say don't feel responsible for changing anyone, but do lead with authenticity, be nice, smile, and find a common ground. Those are the three things that I do. Does that help? Okay. And while I got the mic, did any of my PKs find that scripture? Matthew 6:21.
There you go.
I'm going to raise an offering later.
Some more questions? Over here. Gentleman in the gray.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. I'm Michael Reese. I'm here with Northwell, one of the sponsors for the event. And I had a question for the gentleman in the middle. I wrote it down because, yeah, we're talking and I was trying to gain all the knowledge. From a mental health perspective, how would you advise black men to embrace vulnerability with their women and support systems when being vulnerable is often seen as a sign of weakness?
That's the $1 million question, ain't it? But you know what? I know it sounds like very difficult, but it's really not, to be honest with you. I think the first thing to say is to go to the black woman, because that's the scenario that you brought up, is to say, I need help. And and it sounds so simple, those three words, I need help. But for men, we have a tendency of not asking for help. But if you were to do that, you would understand how much that would make the woman feel comfortable to help you and go above and beyond for you, because they know how difficult it was for you just to say those three words. But to get there, you got to open yourself up. And trust me, I know as men, it's not easy for us to do that, because the world taught us we got to be tough, we got to be bold, we got to put our head down and get to work. But there are times when we feel weak. And to be weak is to be strong. But you have to see in that lens if you are open to it. So when I tell you that, I kid you not, black women really love us. They want to support us. They want to be there for us. So don't let society dictate, oh, no, they don't want to be there. They love us so much. Trust me. But you got to give them the opportunity to be there for you. If you could do that, I promise you, I can almost guarantee you'll see them in a better light. Society will see them in a better light, because we're also bringing them down too, right? They're aggressive. These terms that are putting negative connotations to a black woman, that is not true. And I hope that as black men, we can protect our black women so they can protect us too.
More questions. Oh, I got over here, gentlemen with the navy blue suit. There we go, yeah.
Michael Greer. I just want to talk a little bit about, or hear about you all's perspective, excuse me, on policy. So we did the policy panel, two policy panels yesterday. Just how you all are impacted by policy and what policies you feel are kind of impacting you all the most. Particularly Cedar Hill, I worked on that hospital deal when I was in the deputy mayor's office. But just either city policy, state policy, federal policy that you feel is really impacting you all in these leadership positions that you feel would allow you all to either you all or the industry or your sector to kind of move more affirmatively or effectively for a better future for us. Just kind of hearing how you all are influenced by policy and how you all think you should be influencing policy to improve the sector.
Let me start with that. So not only are we influenced by policy, everyone in this room is influenced by policy, okay? Don't misunderstand it. A couple of things I want to say about policy. I'll answer your question and I'll give you kind of the blueprint as I developed it or as I found it. So my hospital is being built. We're going to see our first patient in around first quarter of next year. About 95% of the population are Medicare, Medicaid. We all know that Medicare, Medicaid pays pennies on the dollar, and you cannot run a hospital solely on Medicaid. But there is a policy that the District of Columbia enacted to give us an enhanced Medicaid rate. So through that policy, we're receiving more than what other hospitals receive for Medicare, and it'll enable us to continue and sustain service for those people that need it. So that's how, that's one way that policy affects, or how policy affects us and it affects change. The second thing I want to talk about is, you know, I talked earlier about discovering my passion to eliminate health disparities, sitting with people, but that's only one of three steps. I mentioned earlier how you have to sit with the people closest to the pain and the problem. That's step one. So you figure out very acutely what the pain and what the problem is. The next step is continuing to sit with them and figuring out what the solution is. You may try and fail the first time, the second time, the 10th time, but on the 12th time, when you get it, you got it. And you realize, okay, this is the solution. But the third and probably the most important step is enacting effective legislation to make sure that that change stays in place long after you're gone. A good example of that is what President Obama did with the Affordable Care Act. He's long gone out of office, but people are still receiving health care. People are walking around enjoying a quality of life with their family because of that policy, right? And when I used to teach, graduate health care administration, and I always talked to my students about the connection between healthcare and policy, healthcare and politics, and I taught for 5 years. Every year that I taught, that distance became closer and closer to where now they're in bed together, right? And you don't have to be in healthcare to see that. So I hope that answers your question, but just remember, in anything that you all do in the healthcare space, make sure you relate it to policy, and if you can't relate it to policy, figure out a way to make that happen, because that's what's gonna continue to sustain the work that you're doing every day after you're gone.
Yeah, I'll jump on that question too. I think one of the reasons why I almost didn't go into medicine was because I loved policy so much. And I was worried that by being in medicine, I'd be too individual and not have an opportunity to actually create systems change. I realized that was the wrong way of thinking about it. The beautiful thing about being in healthcare is we get proximity to people, and policy is all about people. So when you have proximity to people, you can create policy that is for people in a better way than almost anyone else can. As healthcare professionals, we have this incredible opportunity to see so many different types of patients every single day. And so for me, when I think about policy, I think about how it is actually a social determinant of health, that in areas that actually have higher voting rates, they have better healthcare outcomes. The reason why is because you can vote out, and locally, you can vote out factories that are being pollutants. You can actually make sure that there's safer communities when it's coming to investing in workforce development or mental health care opportunities. And so for me, when I started making my social media account, I knew I never wanted to just stay talking about healthcare. I wanted to go beyond to talk about policy because I think healthcare and policy are one and the same. And so now a lot of the work I do is how do I communicate new policies that are coming out? Things like the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which has invested millions of dollars into mental health care for communities that communities can actually have access to. But if we don't know about these types of policies that are out there, how can we actually use them in our own lives? There's policies as well about things like getting internet coverage and connectivity. If you make under a certain amount, you can actually get your internet paid for by the government by applying online. And so there's all these types of opportunities that a lot of people don't know about right now that directly relate to our health, whether it's when it comes to like internet and telemedicine. One thing we don't talk about a lot is like the digital divide. There's all these different types of things where policies can help rectify these rifts when it comes to our communities and healthcare disparities. If anyone wants to learn more, I have a podcast actually. It's called The Dose. It's with the Commonwealth Fund. And I talk with a lot of leaders about policy and how we can be using policy to drive change in healthcare specifically. But I think there's so many ways that we as a community need to make sure that we're understanding policy, because we can see the harms of what happens when we don't as well. You think about what's happening with the Supreme Court right now. There've been multiple different cases when it comes to healthcare that have been transformational. Obviously, Roe v. Wade, we heard about that, the Dobbs decision a few years ago. But do people know that the Dobbs decision actually has made it so that there's less reproductive health access in specific communities, specifically in the South, right? And then you think about the fact that like EMTALA, thankfully they upheld it, but EMTALA was essentially an emergency medicine treatment act where anyone that goes to the emergency department has to get care. And they were actually almost going to remove EMTALA in the case of an abortion, saying that we can no longer give an emergency abortion. Thankfully, the Supreme Court said we're not going to change it. But these are things that are at risk every single day. And there's tons more cases, policies that are being passed every single time. That's why earlier I talked about the other side does a really good job of understanding policy and understanding the ways that policy can be used to negatively impact communities. We need to make sure we're understanding what's happening all the time at play. We're in D.C. right now, the place where things are happening. But these policies affect us every single day. If they won't affect us, they'll affect our children and our future generations.
Can we give all of our panelists a round of applause? We have reached our time. It's time for the sisters to grace the stage and share about Black women leading and achieving healthcare. But again, thank you to our panelists. Thank you, brothers, for being here and sharing your stories, your journeys, dropping gems. This was powerful. I know a lot of people took a lot away from what you had to say. So thank you. All right.